Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. Today is going to be, I think, a real fun experience. And the reason I say that is if you're like me, the old tales of the West are sort of mesmerizing when they come up on television. But so much of it is fictionalized that we don't really know truth from fiction. Well, the gentleman that I have with me today, his name is Peter Decker. This is a guy that has written a fictitious book called Saving the West. But let me tell you, there's a lot more fact than I think fiction in this particular book, and it is a perfect book for summer reading. Peter, I want to welcome you to the show.
Good to be on the show, Donna. Thank you.
I so enjoyed your book. There were times that I laughed, and other times I would say, son of a gun. I read about different things on politics and other things that you've managed to put in there, and I went, whoa, perfect time for this book to come out. Now, I want my audience to know something about you, Peter, because you're a man that has quite a unique and, I would say, most impressive background. You were a policy analyst and speechwriter during Senator Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign. You have written other books on the history of the Western United States. You've been a collegiate professor at Duke University. You are an Army veteran. You also were an Associated Press correspondent in Vietnam and Laos. And you really have firsthand experience regarding the Old West because you've been a cattle rancher, but not just a cattle rancher. You were the former commissioner of agriculture for the state of Colorado, and you also served as a board member of the Federal Reserve Bank in Denver, Colorado. So there's a lot of things that you could talk about, but my goodness, this with the West. First of all, why did you think you wanted to be a cattle rancher?
Donald, when I was in high school, I used to work on ranches in Montana. The ranch that I worked on most was a sheep ranch in the Gallatin region in Montana. It kind of got in my blood. The ranching did, the sheep didn't. I never much enjoyed working with sheep. We used to say they'd wake up every day trying to figure out a new way how to die, and they'd have it figured out by dinner time.
But I did
like ranching and like the outside work, and for a number of reasons, I quit the academy and moved to Colorado and did what I always thought I might want to do. I can't say I did it totally successfully, but we've had a good time doing it.
Now, a lot of you is in this book, I feel. I think that there is so much. You've pulled characters out of real life that you've breathed an image into. But I was absolutely enthralled with how you described the environment. And we start off with John Marlowe, but the very first sentence in the book starts off with a Jody Marlowe, who is his wife, who has lived on this ranch, and life is anything but sweet and comfortable. I just love the way people romanticize, you know, being out and dealing with floods, sick animals, and disease, and invasions of different type of insects, or all kinds of things, or these horrific storms that will come through that can hit so hard that it can wipe out an entire range of animals in just a very short period of time, just a matter of hours. Why do you think it's so hard for people to really get a grip on this? Is it because we're not living very much of it anymore?
I think that's part of it. After we've destroyed something, we like to romanticize it. I think of cowboys who we romanticize. It's probably a good thing we do romanticize it because no one would do the work if we really that, you know, if we were really realistic about the kind of work and the wages and living conditions and lack of insurance that most of them have, I've always been surprised, and more than surprised, sometimes hurt by the romanticization of the West and its lifestyle, both in fiction and in film. Mm-hmm. And most of it, of course, comes from film. We have John Wayne and Randolph Scott and that crew. And you know, if you saw all the John Wayne movies, you'd think that this is really very pleasant work. Not only pleasant, but profitable.
Mm-hmm. And that's not true.
Sometimes it is profitable. I will tell you though that it's tough work, and there are a lot of injuries involved, and I've had to give it up because of a bad leg, and I've had many injuries, and it comes with the territory. So I don't complain about it, and I accept it. And but I recognize also that it's not the romantic work that where the deer and the antelope play.
Oh, I just think it, and your book is just really terrific. I like what you said, or what was in your biography, that you had spent in the first year of your doing ranching, you had one of his neighbors come to see you after you'd gotten back from a trip to New York. And, of course, the first year you had to learn about building fences, corrals, irrigating meadows, taking care of sick animals, and they don't have a clock that they run by. It happens anytime. Almost, it's just amazing. And he came up to you and said, I understand you have a PhD. Well, let me tell you, in this country, that stands for post-hole digger, and you damned well better learn how to use one. And I thought, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've heard PhD piled higher, deeper, and that type of thing, but I haven't heard this one about the post-hole digger. So
yeah.
It really was...
The guy who said that it was a neighbor of mine right across the street. He died about 4 years ago, and he was a real old-timer, and he fed his cattle in the winter with a horse and sleigh. We'd pile the hay on the sleigh, and then he'd dump it off in the snow for the cattle. And one day I did it with him. It was 45 degrees below zero.
Oh,
yeah,
I've been in cold like that. That is numbing.
You didn't have to plug in those horses. They were ready to go. Just give them a bucket of oats, and off they went.
Yes, and that's something that a lot of people don't realize, how important horses are and were to ranching, but that they many times will be able to function where the machines can't. And when you get down to 40, 50... 60, even 70 below zero, forget the machinery. It just doesn't work. But you have a section in your book where a guy starts an engine and gets it going because it's something that a relative of his used to do when temperatures would get brutal. I mean, you have all these little nuggets that are scattered throughout your story, and your personalities that you have in this story, I just think they're a hoot. But Jody and John, This is a married couple. Jody is sick and tired of this stuff, and there's a lot of women that felt the same way during the good old ranching days, but this is a modern-day rancher. And the reality was that his wife knew, as far as John was concerned, the ranch comes first. And he is a son, and it's hard work for her. She's supposed to be out doing all the things, and there's no conveniences in their place because he can't afford them, and all of his money is going into his ranch. So right there at the beginning, most women reading this, the first thing they go, I don't think that would be for me.
Women have as many horse accidents as men. The horse doesn't know the gender of the rider.
That's
so,
right.
It can be as unpleasant for women as it is for men.
Oh yes, I know that. I had a friend who had a sheep ranch, interestingly enough, when he was growing up, and this is many years ago. And he said they would have to go out early in the morning, and the women had to be up cooking food and packing it because the men would be out all day with the sheep, driving them to different ranges. So yeah. They had to have adequate food. And he said nobody ever was on a diet there because you worked it off wherever you went.
That's right.
But it was hard work. He said you had to be up early, you had to really know your animals, and you had to be out there. And it wasn't sweetness and light because you could have, thunder and lightning storms. You could have snow flurries. You could have heavy snow drifts and checking on them and all kinds of things, which is a lot of what you bring out. Now, John, the character, has a New York City person that's going to invest in his ranch because he's right on the margin. He's just about ready to lose everything.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
The question is, how did you put together this character? Where did you base this, or what did you, this character, Charles, from New York City, thinks that this is just absolutely a wonderful place, and he's interested in investing in his ranch. How did you get this theme? Is this something that's pretty common today?
I think it is, yeah. It is around our neighborhood in the mountains of Colorado, and I know it is up in Montana also, and around the Jackson Hole area. There are a lot of wealthy Wall Street investment bankers who invest in ranches, and for any number of different reasons, and they're very dependent, as my novel tries to show, they're very dependent on their managers.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't bring many skills to ranching, except maybe financial skills.
Right.
But they bring a lot of enthusiasm, and they keep money in the cattle economy, I guess, which is good also. And by the way, they also, because they really appreciate the land, they are good preservers of the land. That is, when my experience is that when a particularly wealthy person from the East buys a big ranch, they're less inclined to split it up and carve it up to make a profit on it than say an old time rancher who doesn't have the capital behind him to maintain that kind of operation anymore.
Now,
so they are, in a sense, preserving the land, which I'm most appreciative of. The other thing, which is interesting, they look at the land, I think, differently than a what I would call an old-time traditional rancher. The people who come out, say, from the East, they look at the land more as a almost, they see the landscape as almost a painting, as an aesthetic, which should not change. The old-timers look at the landscape more as a workplace rather than as an aesthetic. And that quite frequently comes up in planning commission meetings and land use planning in the West. People have a different vision of a landscape.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of Ted Turner, who bought how many acres did that guy buy? And of course, he had buku bucks; he could do it. And but he didn't want any of it touched. He wanted it left alone. He wanted the animals left alone. And you bring out so many fascinating facts. And one of them is regarding elk. And in your story, one, the new owners or the powers that are associated with the new owner don't want the elk hunted.
Yeah.
And that information, share with us where that basis of information came from. Was this something of your experience that you found?
I mean, we have... on our small ranch, I bet we have in the winter about 120 elk that come in. And in a real cold winter, they're fighting off the cows for the hay. And I've seen these elk, using their horns quite aggressively against our cows, not only in the feed ground, but also on the salt licks. And in the spring, they'll come in and take off all that new fresh grass before your cows can get to it. So they can be expensive to your operation. They're wonderful to look at, and I like to have them on the ranch, but I sometimes wish they wouldn't eat so much.
But one of the points that you bring out is that for a lot of the families that lived out there, they would hunt elk to keep the elk populations down because there weren't any natural predators that were in the area.
Yeah. It's interesting. In our area, in the around the turn of the century, between the Indians, the Ute Indians who were native to this area, and the settlers, they had pretty much decimated the deer and elk population. It wasn't until the 1920s when Colorado, like other states, had game laws. With the game laws, that is to say a season when you could shoot and hunt animals, which limited hunting, it wasn't until then that these herds rebuilt themselves. And in Colorado's case, we imported the excess elk from Wyoming and brought them down to Colorado, which is essentially the foundation of the elk herd we have in the state now.
Mm-hmm. You described so vividly in your book, Saving the West, what a cowboy has to do. Now, cowboys, my goodness, the cowboy era did not last very long.
Well, in the sense of the old-time cowboy who had these mm-hmm. these long trail rides, say from Texas up to Kansas or Montana, no, that was short-lived. But you know, we still have cowboys, and they're still in demand, and especially good ones with a multitude of skills, not just riding, but a cowboy today has to know how to irrigate. He has to know how to ride, how to train a horse, how to rope, and how to fix equipment, and how to hay. Should know something about electricity so that he can work on vehicles. And it's a multi-skill job. It's not just riding the range with the deer and the elk. And I once wrote an article the title of which was "Cowboys Need Not Apply," and the guy who was hiring, and that was an advertisement, was essentially saying, "I need a cowboy, yes, but I need a cowboy with a lot of skills, mm-hmm. not just the old-time skills."
Mm-hmm. There, with animals, and again, you cover this so nicely in your book, people don't realize how many diseases can affect animals. And you talk about foot rot, a blistered udder, cancer eye, various strains of scours, as you called it, diphtheria, pneumonia, intestinal blockages, mastitis, and plant poisons
yep.
that have been ingested. I mean, you just go through, you know, you go through this list and you go, holy Christmas. You have to have medicines with you because if they're free-range cattle and you're trying to herd them up, you're doing
yeah.
everything you can to try to keep them healthy. And there's so many people, when they go into the supermarket, they don't realize when it comes to having free-range cattle, this isn't something that's done. You know, we don't have an add water and mix special here. This
yeah.
really is a lot of work.
Yeah, a lot of work and a lot of skills. A cowboy also should know how to doctor animals
mm-hmm.
for particular disease, and the good ones do know how. And first of all, you have to diagnose what the disease is, or not necessarily a disease, but what the what the infection is, or is it pneumonia, is it diphtheria, is it plant poisoning, and then you take it from there. I mean, I know cowboys who can, in the middle of the night, do a C-section on a cow, and that is not an easy procedure.
Oh,
I mean, you have to go through about five layers of tissue, and then bring the calf out and keep it all clean and warm on a cold April night, and then re-sew up the cow. And that's not an easy procedure. Obviously, you'd love a vet to do it, but sometimes a vet isn't available.
Mm-hmm. No, I think your book just gives so much information about the modern-day world and the realities of what it is to be involved with a ranch and how vital it is to have skilled personnel. And it really is a 24/7 job, because when you're dealing with animals, you can't just put them on hold and go leave them for a couple of days. It doesn't work.
No, they don't take Christmas off.
No, they don't. And so they're out there. It's really quite a quite an amazing lifestyle.
Yeah.
Now,
and
you
if you like to work outside, it's very rewarding in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of John's story is the fact that this ranch was owned by his granddad. His dad inherited it, but then he had a lot of financial problems. And ranching is a tough job. It's a very, very tough job. And it's a very expensive situation to be in. And with all of the costs and the various things that go on, and here he is, your character finds that there's a guy that wants to invest in the property, because he's in bankruptcy, wants to invest in the property. And, of course, he wants to keep John on because John has the knowledge. But John and the accountant get into a situation, and I just love the way this ended up. But I won't go into that part because that's towards the end of the book. But this accountant is really a numbers person. He doesn't have a clue about the real life in the ranching world, does
he? I knew ranch accountants like that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, and I love the way John said that you have to think like a cow, which is not too fast. And I just think that that is really, really good. Now, he talks about what you look for in cows. Now, for those of you listening, you may think, gee, Donna, is this good reading? Yes, it is, because this John, this character John, is a character. He really is. He's got a good sense of humor. He's got this person that's wanting to invest in his property, which will give him a nice income, and he'll be able to keep his lifestyle up, which he loves dearly, being a cowboy and taking care of the animals. He has a passion for it. But he also has a challenge, and this one I've got to share. The guy from the east wants to build a house on a piece of the property that belonged to John's family, and they don't want him to do that. And there's some sneaky stuff that goes on to sabotage that. What's the story about that one, Peter?
Oh, you mean with the mice?
Yeah, that was sneaky.
Yeah, well, that's made up. I really used that as an excuse in the book. However, I do know of, and I won't name names, a couple of cowboys who have transferred some of those mice around so that they can preserve a particular piece of property from development.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, that mouse in the book was, in fact, still is, I believe, on the threatened species list, not the endangered, but at least the threatened.
Mm-hmm.
So that wherever you found the mouse, you couldn't develop, and that's what John was using as an excuse to his boss that he couldn't build on this particular piece of property, which was also the family cemetery.
Mm-hmm. You bring out a lot of facts regarding the environment And you talk about the western pine beetle that destroyed over 10 million acres of forest land in the West. You talk about lightning and how, and anybody that's got any knowledge understands lightning can start fires, and they can just be devastating. And Montana, Wyoming, New Mexico, Colorado, these places all get hit with this stuff. So what do you, when you were doing this, were you having fun when you were writing these characters?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, some of the characters took on a life of their own. They'd go do things that I hadn't planned for them to do. And I had to bring them back from time to time. The timber thing in Colorado in the West, the western pine beetle, it's been very, very destructive. I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking about over 100 million acres in the West that is infected. Wow. And it's a real fire danger because these trees are dead, just one lightning strike in the middle of a forest where there is a lot of dead timber can be absolutely devastating. We've had that example down in New Mexico. Earlier this spring, we had it not too far away from me about 2 weeks ago outside of Grand Junction, just standing or fallen dead timber, which is fuel for big, big fires. And I don't think that the government has come up with a solution to this. Mm-hmm. And there have been some instances I know where they've tried to spray. I'm not certain whether or not that's been successful. It's also very, very expensive. I mean, we're talking about a landmass probably the size of Connecticut.
Well, your book has adventures that John experiences. He ends up going to New York City. He has confrontations with the accountant, and he has his own way of getting sweet revenge on that one, which I thought was charming. And then you have Amanda and Trish. These are two various females that have stories, and I won't say which one has the love story and love interest that begins to affect John. Jody's his wife, but she's not a strong character in the book as far as I'm concerned, but boy, golly, you sure do bring a lot of things to life. And it gives a lot of insight into people and the way they respond. And you show the camaraderie and the support that ranchers give to each other. It's not unlike what happens with farmers.
Yeah.
People say, if you need help, we're going to help you. And how foreign that is to many people who come out of the city. Let's say. They don't understand it. They don't get it because that's not in their everyday environment. But it is a different world. People realize that lots of times they can't handle everything on their own, and others will say, well, I'll pitch in. That seems to be a pretty consistent pattern among farmers and ranchers. Am I correct?
Yeah, I think it is. And I tried to, without overgeneralizing, I tried to make the point in the book that there really is a difference between a rural culture and urban culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was, to give you an example, when I was teaching at Duke, I taught a course on rural America, and my students mostly were suburban kids or city kids. And they would, some of them would get it. You know, I'd have them read books on rural America and rural characters. The course came to be nicknamed Hicks, Hayseeds, and Shit Kickers.
Okay.
I mean, that was... That was their take on rural America, you know, in a fun way. I mean, I don't mean that in a very serious mm-hmm. way, but it was fun teaching urban and suburban kids about rural America.
I agree, and I think it's something every kid should experience on one level or another because it makes you aware that we can't take things for granted, that there is an infrastructure for food supply that is usually not even thought about by the average person, because we have, in this time frame, we just expect it to be there. And, excuse me, there is a big, big reality that goes behind being able to supply people with food, whether it's grain, whether it's meat, it doesn't make any difference. And your book covers that so well. I know we're out of time, Peter. Do you have a website that people can go to find out more about saving the West?
I do. It's westernslopepress.com. And it lists their, you can read about Saving the West, recent book, and about my previous books.
Well, Peter, I think you've done an incredible job with this. Peter Decker is my guest today. Saving the West, boy, it goes into environmental issues. There's so much fact within the structure of fiction. It really is an education of itself, and I'd recommend it for a read. I just think it's fascinating. And Peter Decker, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, Donna. I much appreciate it.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. More good things to share. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. And toll-free telephone number, if you would like to call in and chat with me, is 888-627-6008. If you're a first-time listener and you wonder what that would involve, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. I'll be happy to share with you my intuitive insights for you. And then you're welcome to ask a question about anything you like. 888-627-6008. I really enjoyed having Peter as a guest today, and his book is just wonderfully, wonderfully done. And I won't give away the ending of it because it is a hoot. It really is. He's got a good sense of humor. But I wanted to share with you, relative to what Peter and I were discussing about the animals and the care for the animals, there was a teacher in Oregon that knew of an area in Oregon where they have ranches, and she wanted to have her students understand what it takes to bring food to the table. So there were a couple of ranchers that said, okay, we'll host the kids. And these were kids in their early teens. They had never, ever been on a ranch or a farm. They didn't have a clue about anything. Well, they spent about a week, I believe it was, out on the ranch. The conditions were they had to work when they came out on the ranch. This wasn't an entertainment happening for them. So, of course, they had to get up early in the morning because all these people are up early in the morning, and they have to prepare for whatever is going to go on during the day. So the kids were involved in the activity of this ranch. So no sleeping in, no cartoons in the morning. They were up, and they were excited because this was something brand new to them. Well, what really brought reality home was not the early hours of getting up and helping to fix breakfast and clean up and then go out, but they had firsthand experience with a cow that was getting ready to drop her calf. But unlike what we see often in the movies, this is a lot of work. And when you have an animal that's over 1,000 pounds and they're giving birth to their baby, we're not talking about a 6 or 7 pounds of something. We're talking about something that might be as much as 100 pounds, dependent. So this particular situation, they had it all on film. The kids were right there. They saw the water break with the cow. They knew delivery was coming, but the animal had to be examined, and the cow was in the wrong positioning. So they had to use some equipment that literally they had to go into with their hands. They had to go into and get the legs of this calf and hook it up to a mechanism, which was chains and shackles, so they could pull this calf out of the mother. Otherwise, she was going to die. The birthing process would kill the cow. So it's not unlike the human experience, but this is a much bigger model. And so they had something that was like a crank. Now, once they had the calf hooked up, they had to have someone on that crank plus someone at the back of the cow to help this calf be birthed. These kids were blown away. Not only did they see this, they saw one of the animals die because it got sick from something. All of these very hard realities. Now, you'd think that maybe a lot of these kids would have just said, oh, this is terrible. I don't ever want to be seeing this again. But that wasn't the case. What happened was that these youngsters were exposed to a world of reality, and they had to work, and they had to do things. And girls and boys both said, wow, this is something that is really important. And the irony about this is that there were some parents that complained. I think this is so funny. My goodness, children shouldn't be put in that kind of an environment. My gracious, how naive people can be to produce food, whether it is animal, vegetable, whatever, or grain. It doesn't make any difference. It's work. And someone, somewhere, is doing it. And if you don't have it, you starve to death, like the people in Somalia. So many times these stories are very important to be able to read and understand, to recognize that there is an infrastructure that makes it possible for us to go to our grocery store and get chickens, to get meat, to get those grains that are so nicely packaged. This did not happen overnight. In fact, I wanted to share with you some information, just a little bit about food history and a couple of other points. It wasn't until after World War II that a lot of the things we take for granted today evolved. You know, in 1946, the U.S. birth rate jumped almost 20% over the previous year. And Gerber Baby Foods, that company, was really starting to get big because there was a baby born every 9 seconds. And by 1953, the U.S. population had grown to 160 million, and that was up from 152 million in 1950 and 141 million in 1946. And, of course, we are now over 300 million, I believe. Well, in 1947, a man by the name of William Levitt introduced the first of prefabricated neighborhoods. We called them track homes when I was growing up. And 17,000 near-identical houses were built in a former potato field on Long Island, New York. Each of these houses came equipped with a refrigerator, a washing machine, and a television, and sold in 1949 for $7,990. And do you know there's a lot of them in California and other parts of the country? They're still standing. This was a two-bedroom place. Two-bedroom homes typically cost $10,000, but because of what he did, it was a substantial savings. So there was that. New suburbs developed. Now, electric washing machines. Boy, I love mine. You know, they've been around since the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century. But in 1947, Whirlpool became a front runner because it introduced the first top-loading automatic clothes machine. And the dual-temperature refrigerator with separate compartments for frozen and chilled foods, that came into place in 1947. And they were dinky little freezers. They were little tiny things. Maybe you could get a couple ice cube trays in it, and that was it. But by the 1950s, the freestanding deep freeze had come and gone. Cars, well, power steering, that came in 1951. Chrysler Crown Imperial was the car that introduced it, and that was the same year that drivers could coast into garages equipped with electric garage door openers. And then mechanical lawnmowers, try 1952. That's right. But I'll tell you something that really hit the big time. That was television. 1952. At the end of 1952, there were more than 15 million television sets in American homes. And previously, there was just about 4 million. You got maybe one or two shows if you were lucky. And do you know what we now have? Look at what started in 52 and look at where we are today. You now can get stuff on your telephone, for heaven's sakes. Unbelievable. Wasn't that long ago? Orange juice, well, Minute Maid, frozen orange juice, concentrate, came about in 1946. And the first boxed cake mix, Betty Crocker, that's right, came out in 1947. And Minute Rice came out in 1948. TV dinners, well, they came out and they just changed the American eating habits in a big way. Jerry Thomas is the one that developed this, and people felt that having a TV dinner was the equivalent of having a maid in the house. No dishes to wash, no pans to scrub, and no oven to clean. And they're still selling. And it's evolved into what we know as these dinners. I mean, look at what Weight Watchers did with it, and Lean Cuisine, and you have Banquet. You have all these different products that evolved from these items that were started so many years ago. But that, it's fascinating to go back and see what started the patternings that enable us today with manufacturing to have the convenience of packaging. I really don't want to go back to the good old days. I'll tell you, I'm not interested in having chickens. At the Renaissance Fair, by the way, this weekend, I was there. And if you are in Western Washington, you want to come out, it is absolutely awesome. You have the Queen's Court. We have jousting. We have just so much stuff going on there. It is absolutely marvelous. And this is the weekend where you can come out and have your masks. And, of course, you can wear costumes anyway. But this is just going to be an awesome weekend. Beautiful weather. And the Renaissance Fair, Midsummer, fair is being held in Bonnie Lake. So I hope you'll come out and do stop by and say hello. Look for the booth that has the bright yellow banners with the gigantic lions on it. And I'll be there doing many sessions with people as well as having a plethora of books to choose from if you'd like to add to your library. But this is a wonderful event. And when I'm there, I think of how people basically during that period, there wasn't hot and cold running water. There wasn't very much in the way of soap. And there just wasn't a heck of a lot of conveniences, but people made do. And when you go back and you step back in history like you do at a Renaissance fair, it should give you pause, make you realize it's taken a lot of very talented people to bring us to the point where we have the freedom to explore and be what we want to be as individuals. Women weren't allowed to go to school because they had to be home hand-washing the laundry, feeding the kids, taking care of the gardens. There's many third world countries that are still in that factor of life. Thank you I'll take this one. Looking pretty is one thing, and being out on the grounds is another. It's an absolutely awesome event, the Washington Midsummer Fair, Renaissance Fair. But I'll tell you what, you want to check out their website. If you're able to come, go to the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair. You'll have all the information there. You'll be able to buy your tickets online if you want, all kinds of good things. But remember, we have a world today that enables individuals, male and female, to make choices. And stepping back in history is great to show you how far we really have come on so many levels. Donna Sebo here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, hey, I've got some goodies for you. Also, I wanted to share with you the get-ahead secrets for your astrological sun sign. And a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And we'll be back in just a minute. Don't go away.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Well, I wanted to share with you a little bit of a mystery that occurred in 1930. They have not found out what happened. But this is how the mystery goes. On August the 6th, 1930, a 41-year-old judge, Joseph Crater, who was handsomely dressed in his best suit and spats, he had been dining with a fellow lawyer and a showgirl that was just absolutely gorgeous at a particular chop house called Billy Hot's. Well, the judge went outside, hailed a taxi. He was on his way to a Broadway show, and he was never, ever seen again. Now, apparently, on August 3rd, a few days before this event happened, he was with his wife at a summer cottage in Maine, and he received a phone call. So he told his wife that he was going to leave and he was going to be back for her birthday. And on August the 9th, he returned to New York City. There apparently were some people that he had to straighten out. Well, he spent his day, August the 6th, at the courthouse while his assistant cashed over $5,000 worth of checks for him. And this judge was known for fooling around. So one of his personnel carried out two locked briefcases to his apartment, and the judge said, okay, you can leave now. I'm going to be going up to this particular area called Westchester for a swim. I'll see you tomorrow. Well, his assistant was sort of surprised because the judge hated swimming. 10 days go by. The judge's wife is quite concerned, but the friend said, oh, don't worry about him, until he failed to appear for court on August the 25th. Now, this is what they found. At the private apartment he had in New York City, they found his clothes, his monogrammed pocket watch, pen, and card case all there. His safe deposit box was empty, and the two briefcases stuffed with money were missing. Well, by the time the month of September came around, the police were called in on September the 3rd. bulletins were sent around the world, and it was in 1931 his wife discovered a secret drawer in a bureau at their apartment. And the drawer contained nearly $7,000 in cash, stocks, a five-year-old will leaving everything to her, and an undated note from the judge listing all of his assets, details of money owed him, and a sentence that read, "I am very weary." An investigator swore that the drawer had been found earlier and it had been empty. He was never seen again, and he was legally declared dead in June 1939. Interesting mystery, isn't it? Donna Sebo here. I promised you that I'd give you some information about your astrological sign, and this is about, well, professional side of you. What are the strong points of your sun sign? So, and this also can apply to a boss. If you know the sun sign of the people that are working around you, it might give you an insight about their personality secrets, and you'll know how to work more effectively with them. So let's start off with Aries. Now, this is from March 21st to April 19th. Those born under the sign of Aries usually like to work, move, and think fast. They don't like to drag their feet. They like to really get into things, finishing them on time, and they like to work until the work is completed. And if this is a boss that you have under this sign, you may find that they expect you to do the same thing. So if you're around people that are under this sun sign, you may want to take on the understanding that you have to be self-motivating. You have to be a self-starter. And being original in thinking, those with the sign of Aries really like it. They really like it. But understand, typically, those under the sign of Aries like to be number one. And what about Taurus? Okay, they like the facts, sort of like Jack Webb with the old program Dragnet, where you start off, just want the facts, man. That's all I want. Just want the facts. Well, they don't like a lot of woo-woo or foo-foo. They want to know exactly what needs to be done, and they like things presented in a very logical manner. And they want your explanations or your ideas presented with that kind of clarity. Now, remember, sometimes these people can be rather bullheaded. That's why the term Taurus applies. So you want to be sure that if you have a coworker around you that is with that kind of disposition, you want to keep them informed, and they don't like getting a whole bunch of unnecessary detail. Again, just give the bare facts. So stick to the point, keep them informed, and remember, those under the sign of Taurus like to know what's going on with the bottom line. Well, that's just a couple of the sun signs relative to that, and I'll share more with you tomorrow and throughout the rest of the week. I know we're out of time here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is something we need to keep in mind, that we're the creators of our destiny by the way we look at life and the action we put out towards it. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about beauty without injections, Helen Day. I think you will enjoy that. And hey, guys, there are a lot of the guys out there that are doing stuff today so they can look better, too. It's not just the gals. Good information, good times. Helen Day will be my guest. Talk to you tomorrow. Have an absolutely awesome day or evening wherever you might be. And believe in yourself. Trust your skills, your talents, and your abilities. You're serving an important place in this world, and it's nice to have you around. Take care. Talk with you, Manana. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.